You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 174A by Rudolf Steiner, 12 lectures, translated by Christiana Bryan, entitled Europe Between East and West in Cosmic and Human History. This is Lecture 4. Given on the 29th of November, 1915, in Munich. This is a time when the experience of death, from the perspective of the physical, both in its wider and closer contexts, confronts our souls, a thousandfold among humanity as a whole, but also within our closer circles, from which, over recent months and years, the souls of many dear friends have departed through the gate of death. It may therefore be timely to direct our observant gaze toward something with which we in this branch may feel especially connected from a particular angle: the riddle of death and its associated mysteries. We will turn our discerning eyes toward this riddle of death, not just because we are plagued by curiosity or a thirst for knowledge, but because we have assimilated from such considerations a certain amount of what spiritual science can offer us regarding the mystery of death. Closely related to this is what we need by way of strengthening forces for life, and how basically by observing death, the chasm between two worlds, the physical world in which we live and the world of spirits, can be eliminated. Haven't we often reminded ourselves, by rightly calling to mind actual concrete deaths, how those souls with whom we were involved in physical life remained connected with us after they had gone through the gate of death? Could I not, in this very branch and in this regard, express that it is among the most fortifying thoughts by which we can accept being sustained that we have friendly souls in the spiritual world, who can and have, because of the ways in which they were once associated with our work and concerns here on earth, become our faithful helpers and co-workers? One does need to emphasize that we live at a time in which we feel duty-bound to work out, to elaborate this spiritual science, a time in which spiritual science is still misunderstood, and from such misunderstanding and non-comprehension stems the enmity we encounter. Sometimes doubts can arise as to whether, in face of such enmity, an opposition which will truly manifest in ever fiercer forms, we will have recourse to sufficient strength to withstand it in terms of what we are vouchsafed within the physical environment. This is when the fortifying thought can arise that those faithful souls of friends who have gone before us and who are unimpeded by the obstacles which still mount up against us here on earth may unite their forces with ours. It is from such convictions that we can believe in the victory, if a slow, gradually ascending victory, of our spiritual scientific work. When a person goes through the portal of death, it is opportune for our souls, if I may put it like this, to experience how they, having laid aside their physical body in the arena of earthly existence, rise and enter spiritual realms, largely leaving behind these physical worlds. If we have acquired a conviction in spiritual science, we may still feel a person's crossing of the threshold of death in terms of their departing the physical world. If the gaze of the spiritual scientist is now directed toward the experience of death, toward a person as they cross the threshold of death, that spiritual researcher's gaze will frame this event rather differently. What primarily forms the focus of consideration is the experience itself undergone by so-called dead individuals, how they themselves experience and feel this passage through the gate of death inwardly, and how their existence is further elaborated between death and a new birth. Here it must be said, what initially transits through the portal of death is, as we know, the ether body, together with the astral body and I, capital. What the deceased feels on entering the spiritual world in this threefold form is that the stage of the physical world, together with all those people with whom they had been connected and everything else related to it, as though all this were leaving them, as though it were to some extent slipping away underneath them. Then the person, having newly gone through the gateway of death, lives their way with their ether body into the etheric world, becoming one with it. We also know this. To their gaze appears a kind of overview of their experience on earth in their recent incarnation. This experience can really be compared with a sort of universal dream experience. In undulating, weaving images of great eloquence and deep significance, does their life run on for days on end? One could say that this panorama of life expands, during which the deceased feels, you see thus far, your life unravels, ebbs away. And beyond this flowing life, the arena in which you previously existed also takes its leave of you. This is a completely etheric experience. Whilst we experience physical sense existence, sensing is hard and coarse, the objects with which we collide, knowing clearly that what we experience through our senses is external to us, and that we feel ourselves to be within the boundaries of our skin, the person beyond the gate of death experiences their existence and interrelatedness with the world in such a way that no such great differentiation is felt. They feel as though the contents of their life's tableau were almost identical with their own self. Yes, this panorama at first constitutes their world. In that great panorama, they survey what they underwent, and it is for them their immediate world, the place of their existence. To some extent, the earthly world sinks away from them, and from this ebbing world there projects what they had experienced since their birth within that earthly life. And this all unravels like a mighty, intensely living pictorial panorama, not in dull dream consciousness, but shot through with vibrantly clear consciousness, not just seeing in images, but such that everything undergone in differing modes during life is revivified. Every single conversation we have had with other people is heard again. Everything we experienced with others, the impressions we shared with them, all this we experience again. It is because everything is flowing, flooding life, that such a wealth of dynamism is possible, which, crammed into a few days, forms a complete overview, one always simultaneously in front of us, of all that we underwent over the course of what may sometimes have been long earthly lives. We go through this knowing, previously on earth, one experience was followed by another. You had an experience. You were at the center of your life's many networks and associations. This one flowed into it, remained a while in your memory, was then partly forgotten. Anon, something new appeared, and so your life's streams flowed together over the years. Now, this is all simultaneity to your soul's I, EYE. Now everything is, if I may put it thus, both within yourself, yet spread out as widely as the world. In these days after death, one does not differentiate between world and self, but both flow together, and the world is simply that which is self-experienced. Initially, there is nothing more than what the self itself experienced, within which everything we have ever undergone with others during earth existence is contained. Then, we feel as though everything that is of external etheric material nature, which had at first appeared as the bearer of this world of images, were to leave us, and as though this world of images were no longer as if observed, but now as something with which our entire being is bound up, and which now totally comprises our inner experience. And because we are simultaneously able to absorb those images into ourselves, we are in turn in a position to sense and experience the rest of the spiritual world, and to survey it with our consciousness. Now, gradually, other human souls appear in the widths of the spiritual world, souls who either went ahead of us through the gate of death and are now there, or souls who are still below in physical bodies, amidst physical life. From the perspective of the spiritual world, one views human souls by seeing them in the form of their soul's spiritual nature. What is physical is only perceptible to physical organs, but the soul spiritual element which clothes the physical can rise up before our soul vision. We feel ourselves far more closely united with all that is being experienced by us than we could feel connected down there, namely on earth, where physical bodies separate us through their inherent boundaries. There is just one thing onto which we must always hold, words, which all bear the imprint of conditions on the physical plane, have to be carefully chosen when depicting what is spiritual, because experiencing in the spiritual world is far more delicate and inward than it is here in the physical world. If we want to bring to mind how a thought representing an experience lying far in our past re-emerges when remembering that experience, how that thought emerges from ourselves when we actively imagine it, and now, I would say, think the reality content of such a shadowy remembered experience, then we gradually achieve a concept as to how spiritual reality actually arises before us after we have gone through the gate of death. This reality does not, as a rule, approach us from outside, as do experiences in the physical sense world. Imaginations do indeed arise in this way, but with endlessly greater vitality than memory images, but in such a way that we do not differentiate between I, capital, and imagination, in the way we distinguish I from external world here. They emerge from us, rising like memory pictures, but in such a way that we know what is arising there on the horizon of our consciousness is reality. Here an imagination arises, and we know it to be as much a part of us as our memory pictures on the physical level. It rises up in full vivacity. We, however, know that we are bound to it and that our I is within it. In this way does the soul ascend. In this way do we feel ourselves to be at one with souls and with the soul being of the higher hierarchies, which gradually appear. I'd like to say that the spiritual world comes toward our own souls from out of indistinct, dark gloaming, in the same way as do those memory pictures that surface into our souls. It is just that memory pictures are more twilight, only depicting an external reality, while the imaginations that arise become speaking imaginations in that they announce their intrinsic being through a spirit language then unveiling itself, a language that then becomes for us a revelation of souls and of spirits with whom we will, in the most multifarious ways, come together more warmly and inwardly than ever we could be with another human being in the physical world. You need to make especially clear to yourselves just what initial experiences human beings have when they stride through the gate of death. The retrospective contemplation of their most recent life is of enormous, vast significance for all their subsequent experiencing between death and a new birth. And we can reinforce our sense of its importance if we think how in physical life we achieve our I consciousness, not our I, but consciousness of our I. How we arrive at our I, we know from our spiritual scientific studies that spirits of form lend us this I, inasmuch as we have progressed from moon existence to earth existence. But this I is at first unconscious. It becomes conscious by being reflected in our physical bodies. How is it reflected here on a physical level? Well, as you know, you can see it in normal dream life. Even in dream life, the I is only very rarely conscious of itself. An I will intermingle, merging with the arising dream pictures. By which means do we experience I consciousness during the day? Be quite clear as to how this I consciousness is connected with all our sense perceptions and with all external experience. If we move our hand through the air, we feel nothing. The moment we hit something, we notice it. Yet we actually notice our own experiencing, sensing, what we feel through our fingers. In bumping into the outer world, we become aware of our eye. In a further sense, do we become conscious of our eye through the fact that on waking we dive down out of sleep consciousness into our physical body. We collide with our physical body. Consciousness of our eye is actually summoned before our soul in this collision with our physical body. Let us be quite clear. Eye consciousness must not be confused with an eye. Initially, an eye remains in the subconscious and is, one could say, incomplete. The true nature of an eye will only be experienced by human beings during the coming Vulcan epoch. But an eye acquires earth consciousness because, with the astral body, it dives down into the ether and physical bodies, colliding with them. In this collision with ether and physical bodies, does that eye become aware of itself? Through it, eye consciousness arises from the moment when the physical body has become hardened enough for the collision to be sufficiently strong. In other words, from that point in early childhood, the point back to which we can remember. Now, the soul also needs to collide with something in life between death and a new birth. Here in physical life, it collides with the physical body, which has bequeathed us by the forces and substances of external nature for the purpose of us attaining eye consciousness. After death, between death and a new birth, in order to attain to its henceforward spiritual eye consciousness, the soul collides with its own life, which in the days after stepping through the portal of death, it has been observing, and back toward which it constantly looks. Firstly, life appears to visual gaze, then it becomes an ever-present retrospective. In that, having gone through the gate of death, we live on in the stream of time. We look back upon what we have directly experienced in and through death. And now, as a spirit being, does the soul stride onward, always looking back and colliding with the panorama of its lived life, which yet remains spiritual recollection. So just as an eye is ignited to eye consciousness by colliding with its physical body down here, similarly is eye consciousness ignited after death by colliding with its own retrospectively viewed past life. By looking back over this, do we experience eye consciousness between death and a new birth. Such eye consciousness is different after death, but is certainly not any the weaker for it. What is this eye consciousness actually, here in the physical world? When we want to become aware of our eye, capital, in the physical realm, it is the case that we are dependent on being shown it by other means within our physical body. Our physical eye appears to us in reflection in the mirror of our physical body. We feel quite passive in the genesis of our eye, at least when we are not imitating a philosopher such as Johann Gottlieb Fichte. By contrast, once we have gone through the gate of death, we feel ourselves to be perpetually active. Ever and ever again do we, as it were, reflect in our now far more intensive consciousness by looking back on our own life and uniting our eye consciousness with the awareness that we will ourselves over and over again do we will ourselves. We are allowed to will ourselves, for we remain indissolubly and enduringly ourselves, because the impressions of all that we have undergone also remain inextinguishable. With these words, I would like to reflect very clearly what is experienced between death and a new birth. Experiencing consciousness between death and rebirth is quite unlike experiencing consciousness here on earth. Here on the physical plane, nobody can actually, with their normal consciousness, look back on their own birth. One's own birth cannot normally be experienced when observed with everyday consciousness. Memory only begins later on. I previously said here, if people rely only on their own experience in life, on having experienced something themselves, then nobody can actually claim to remember their own birth, unless they look back clairvoyantly. If someone says, "I won't believe in the spiritual world until I see it for myself. I won't believe what spiritual science presents, and I only believe what I myself have seen," one can simply reply, "And what about your own birth? You cannot have had much experience of this." So you see from this that only the consequences of even something as highly significant for human life as birth can be deduced by normal consciousness. Our normal consciousness only ever assumes that we were born by concluding that we look quite like the people of whom we observe that they too were born, hence we must also have been born. But this only relies on inference. It is quite different during the time between death and a new birth. As little as one can look back with normal consciousness on one's own birth, does one all the more intensively look back through the remembered panorama of one's life to the moment of one's death. As truly as the experience of birth is extinguished for earthly consciousness, just as truly does the event of one's death remain within the soul's backward-looking consciousness between death and a new birth, but now seen from the opposite side. This may have some gruesome aspects, yet one cannot conclude from this that it is terrible for the individual living onward to have to constantly look back to their death, because from that perspective, it is the greatest, most wonderful, most meaningful experience a soul can ever have, and because in ever-radiant glory, it illustrates how the spirit triumphs over material existence. This enduring retrospective to the moment of death is an all-revitalizing, all-heightening, and uplifting, universally conscious-enhancing experience. The soul reflects primarily through this death experience, "I live here in the spiritual world with the spiritual world." To the extent that a soul has the strength to say this to itself, does the experience of death hold mighty significance for each newly beginning onward life. I was saying, the human being feels how their body and everything that coexisted on earth now leaves them. They feel how through their inner activity, they now have to compensate their consciousness, how they have to produce something for their consciousness, which was previously bestowed on them for that purpose, while their body was their instrument. Quote, "I can exist consciously within myself without my body." Close quote. The potential in grasping this thought produces a far more powerful awareness than can be had within earthly life. Death gives us this conviction so that you can sense your body is receding, but a time is now beginning in which you no longer rely on colliding with your body to feel yourself to be an I. A time is now starting when you can, to some extent, yourself pour spiritual forces into the sheaths of your soul so as to continually summon yourself to consciousness. Through recognizing that this activity of summoning yourself to consciousness pertains once your body has been torn from you, do you have a real-life impression of inwardly creating an existence? That begins at death, when one has to begin to experience oneself without one's body. Death is the starting point for living onward without a body, to feeling oneself to be an ego by looking backward to the event of death. When the gaze of the spiritual researcher, by allowing the spiritual world to come alive within, reaches the point where souls who have gone through the gate of death emerge as if into their inner life, onto their field of observation in the form of imaginations, then one learns to know how the deceased are experiencing. One learns to detect differences that arise, and one can, of course, only ever describe particular instances. We will look at one such differentiation. One learns, as if in an arena, a soul observatory, how human souls present themselves after death. These souls are of two kinds. Those human souls who have entered the spiritual world earlier, before our own death, whom we find therein as disembodied souls, and those souls who are still embodied on earth. We are just as capable of empathizing and co-experiencing with these latter souls who remain on earth. As the arena of terrestrial existence withdraws from us, the potential remains open to know ourselves still to be connected with what was our soul component. Only our physical surroundings vanish from us, while our souls expand, uniting with the widths of the universe. And precisely due to this, are we given the possibility of knowing ourselves to be remaining connected with souls and able thereby to experience them still. But there is a difference between experiencing one quality of soul from the other kind. If we experience a human soul in the spiritual world, we naturally, I would hardly need to say this were it not for those who have grasped nothing of spiritual vision, still believing it so, do not encounter it as if approaching it just as one meets people externally. But one feels the being in question emerging, arising in one's consciousness. Now, in a soul already disembodied, who has gone through the portal of death and whom we encounter, we have an inner awareness that they are present. The impression begins in this way. We are aware. Here is a soul. At the same time, we have to live into it, to feel our way into it. We have to receive the imagination of them in such a way that we feel involved in the creation of that imagination. I would really like to describe the matter as follows. You feel yourself to be in the spiritual world. The awareness dawns that you are no longer alone, that a soul is nearing. Now it is as if in the physical world you are bearing a thought invisibly within you. Yet you wish to make it visible, so you take a chalk and draw that thought, making it into a picture. It really is initially like this in the spiritual world. You know that there is a real spirit present. In order to see a soul, you first need to come into contact with it in such a way that you, as it were, draw it as an imagination into spiritual space. You do this knowing yourself to be active in creating that imagination. And if it is through the music of the spheres that its being allows it to speak to our being, much in the way that our language announces our souls here in the physical world, when it allows the music of the spheres to resound from itself, you feel as though you cannot remain passive. If you hear the speech of a person and you do not wish to think, you need not understand it. You have to participate if you wish to understand someone. This is also what you have to do in this realm. You create a coexistence with them, actively and dynamically, knowing that every part of the soul's being and appearance, which could appear before you, has to be co-created as an apparition, a phenomenon. You create the appearance, not the being. It may also be the case that you don't feel so strongly active, but then know a human soul is present here. Yet it may of its own accord strive to become an imagination without our active participation just described. The imagination appears to us more of its own accord. Then we are encountering a soul who is still embodied on earth. Once the human being has gone through the gate of death and is gradually living on in spiritual worlds, they learn in this way how to relate to other souls, to distinguish between souls they meet in the spiritual world and those whom it has to think of as being displaced onto earth. With this, I have specified one of the differentiations that transpire when directly experiencing the spiritual world. Thus, experience, spiritual experience, is also necessary in differentiating whether one is meeting human souls or whether one is experiencing things of the higher hierarchies. Consider what I have described as the experience of human souls. I said, You encounter human souls either in such a way that you create or you recreate imaginations, or that they appear largely of themselves. The experience can, however, be like this. You are aware that a being is present. That being has to appear before us as an imagination. Also in our experience, if you really wish to sojourn in their company. But it will not immediately be possible for us to create this imagination with any immediacy, in the same way as just described, where in some instances it constructs itself largely by its own activity. We need to develop something quite different within us when we sense that a being is present. We need to educe the following feeling. We make way for that being to create within us. We relinquish some forces so that the forces of the being in question can instead stream into us. Whilst we feel ourselves, in the case of a human soul, to be participating creatively in forming the imagination, we feel, in the presence of a being of the higher hierarchies, or from the ranks of the Angeloi or Archangeloi, how these beings themselves create imaginations within us. In this way do we gradually find our way into co-experiencing in spiritual worlds. We also know quite concretely that this co-experiencing takes place over the course of many long years. Its length in relation to the previous life on earth has often been studied, and that life will run in reverse order. First, we have a couple of days of life's panorama. Then we begin to live backward through our lives, but differently from the way in which we lived here between birth and death. We experience the last first, then what came before it, and so backwards in spirit until our birth. We experience it by observing our lives, but now from the opposite perspective. I can tell you that we see it from a perspective of effects. To take a crude example, once in my life I said to someone, "You are an ignoble person," or I injured them in some other way. I experienced something in my life. What I felt is something quite different from what they felt. They felt insulted and pained. They experienced sorrow. Now, reliving this after death, in the soul world, you yourself experience by its effect what you have done. The sorrow felt by the other through our derogatory insult, this pain and sorrow we now experience in its effects on ourselves. Through this retrospective life do we undergo the effects of our deeds as they were experienced in the other person. We can gain a certain glimpse of this post-mortem experience. If we turn our attention to a connection, the spiritual researcher can uncover between impressions after death and those here in the physical world. What I am now talking about is something that can alert us to how the spiritual researcher, little by little, gradually arrives at their conclusions, and how it is prejudiced to opine that anyone who has crossed the threshold into the spiritual world would know that world on the basis of their own visions, and that they could answer any question randomly put to them. Over and over again we see that when a spiritual researcher speaks of this or that in public and engages in a question and answer session, how what might from a certain perspective seem desirable in answering a question about all things in heaven, earth, and all things eternal, is then assumed. Whoever can see into spiritual worlds already knows everything, every single thing that there is to know. That is about as clever as someone here present saying, "You have eyes, you know Munich, so describe California to me." In spiritual worlds, it is actually the case that one has to proceed step by step, gradually acquiring what needs to be grasped of spiritual worlds. It is naive to believe that it somehow doesn't apply that everything first has to be observed step by step. It is quite different in spiritual worlds from here in physical existence. here in the physical, let's say, that you've never been to Heidelberg, and yet you want to describe Heidelberg. So you bestir yourself and travel there. In the spiritual world, things have to approach you, and you have to evolve inner patience and experiential forces in your soul. Things come into your view once you have sufficiently readied yourself. The Heidelberg of the spiritual world has to approach us, and we have to prepare our souls for it to do so. It always depends partly on the extent to which we are blessed as to whether we can experience one thing or another spiritually. It is in this way that the spiritual researcher can very gradually uncover mysteries of the spiritual world and also be instructed about them while there. Today I would like to talk about a particular result of spiritual research, one not yet discussed here from that vantage point. Once you have developed and made accessible certain inner powers of spiritual observation, and watched how the human being tarries in spiritual worlds between falling asleep and waking up, viewing the sleeping human being as a soul, as it exists outside its physical body, you find out various things on the basis of gazing, which in one sense have to be learned if you wish to take hold of something. You notice that a person is in fact continuously active in soul, much more active than when they are awake. While awake, a person makes use of such activity as their body has cultivated, and into this do they, in soul form, transpose themselves and exist. By contrast, during sleep, they live within their own activity. In following this, you notice that people relive differently what they have undergone in the physical world between waking up and falling asleep. Let's imagine that I have done something, or have read this or that. While asleep, I experience all that reading once again, going through it all. Nowadays, we have as yet no awareness in normal life that this also becomes I consciousness, and yet it plays out at a soul level, however dully, extending far enough for the soul to actively elaborate what it has experienced during the day. Thoughts are transformed in soul so that they become fruitful for us. We assimilate as the fruits of living what we have undergone during the day. Ever actively do we work on those fruits of living, those results of life, and this is what we do during sleep. The spiritual researcher can discover something. If they compare this experience of sleep, which human beings undergo, with those undergone by human beings in the years or decades after they have gone through the gate of death, while wandering through their lives backward, it is interesting that people travel through their lives such that they relive their nights and not their days. As they had looked back on the day every night, it is this that they traverse in the soul world. It is the same as what they had experienced during the day, but now viewed from the perspective of sleep. How we experience this is quite remarkable. We don't usually think about it, but our memory here in the physical world actually only stretches across events of the day. We remember what we did during waking consciousness. Now, after death, we remember precisely those nocturnally relived daytime earthly experiences. That is where the conscious memory of our nocturnal processing arises. I haven't expressed this so clearly before simply because I did not yet know it. Such things transpire and appear to one during sequential spiritual research. One important thing, as it were, steps into the light of day, something important for the consciousness and work we ought to be creating in our branches and communities. Previously, and from another viewpoint, you can read about it, I drew attention to the fact that life in the land of soul lasts approximately one-third of the time spent between birth and death. The reasons for this are elaborated in those books. But the reasons given there are from an angle different from that which I am sharing today. You relive your experiences of the night. How long does one normally sleep? This equates to sleeping roughly one-third of one's life. Striding through these nights after death will take a third of one's lifetime. This is connected with length of nocturnal elaborating, something immensely interesting and important. This fact was previously given on the basis of different reasoning. I documented it, for instance, in title Occult Science and Outline. A third of one's lifetime is the length during which one relives the latter after death, during life in Kamaloka. Now, from a completely different perspective, one not previously thought of, the same transpires. Kamaloka lasts around one-third of a lifetime on Earth, but now from the angle that one relives one's nights. So you see, these things arise over and over again and are immensely supportive and strengthening as proof for the veracity of what spiritual science can offer human beings. You seek a truth from a certain angle and arrive at it from elsewhere, at the fact that Kamaloka endures a third of a lifetime. You confirm the same fact from a diametrically opposite direction. Results of this kind are mutually supporting. This can often come to one, assuring one while giving certainty to those who cannot yet research for themselves. I have often mentioned this congruity. By really following as individuals together within the life of these branches, how such topics are researched, do we gradually conquer for ourselves an inner certainty and the power of conviction, even though we may have to exert ourselves over long periods along our own paths to knowledge in order to reach our own experiential conclusions. Now, in conclusion, I would like to share a truth with you, one of particular interest for our time, though always of general interest. In a public lecture, I spoke from one perspective about deaths that can take place when, say, someone in the bloom of youth is hit by a bullet, that in one sense their physical body is taken from them. I spoke about, and have previously shown from various angles, what becomes of those unspent forces. Today, I want to add another slant to that experience of death. How do those pass on and enter spiritual worlds, those from whom their physical body has vanished, not due to illness or old age, but who have lost their physical bodies forcibly by bullet or other injury? What becomes of their unspent forces? This was what I explored. How they actually enter the spiritual world themselves becomes a mysterious riddle. In times such as ours, you see so very many souls entering the spiritual world. Their bodies have been taken from them by external means. They differ sharply from those souls whose bodies have been taken by old age or illness. To explain and understand questions such as these, one has to be able to place what is correct alongside what else is correct in spiritual worlds. You have to be able to ask, with what does one have to combine a phenomenon, which has become a riddle, in order to elucidate it? It transpires that you have to place the phenomenon alongside something you can experience in the physical world. Now, we want to characterize experience in the physical world initially by looking toward those crudely materialistically minded spirits who are not willing to rate anything other than what can be starkly conceived of with sense perceptions, and which, because it makes a crude impression, they designate as existing. But there are other things in this world that make life valuable, and these others are ideals. Admittedly, the most crassly confirmed materialists will say, you can't eat ideals. They don't exist in any proper sense. They're just thought up. But people who actually work toward truly cultivating, elevating, and vitalizing earth existence are those who import ideals. Whatever does not exist in the crudest materialistic sense has to be brought into the course of earth existence to the end that this life be made valuable. Idealists are in a sense harbingers from divine worlds. For ideals are like messages from divine realms. They need to be rightly introduced into the world, yet they do not originate in the physical world. You cannot observe ideals, nor can you experiment with depicting them through experience. Nevertheless, ideals are like messengers from a spiritual world. The human soul, who through a bullet in the bloom of youth has been bereft of their body, ascends through the portal of death into spiritual worlds, leaves behind not only unspent forces to be used, as I indicated earlier, but also brings into the spiritual world a quite distinct consciousness. Such souls enter the spiritual world differently from those who could complete their lives or those whose body has been taken from them through illness. Such souls enter spirit land, bearing thoughts about what might have been down there in the physical, namely what their own lives could have been from the point onward at which they sacrificed themselves. All that could have taken place over the following years of their natural lives, as far as capacities are concerned, had been assigned to the physical world. It might have been possible, let's say, that 2 years after they died, their body, as a physical body, might still have been on its feet among others. Now they are no longer present. Something which might have existed in the physical world is there no more. This is what a soul whose body has been taken from them now takes aloft into the spiritual world. Now it also needs to be announced aloft to the spiritual world how, down there in the world, something intended for the harsh conditions of existence is not living out its days amid that harsh material existence. This announcement is for the spiritual world akin to a declaration of ideals in the physical world. These are the, in quotes, inverse idealists. Down here, life can proceed such that potential is not realized, that souls return from the physical world having forcibly encountered death. Among those up there who have not experienced this, an announcement is made, signifying the same as does a declaration of ideals here. Here, in physical existence, it can be declared. Not only that which makes an impression on the senses is of value, but ideals are something precious, stemming as they do from spiritual realms. In the spiritual world, those whose bodies have been taken from them announce that there is something effective which, albeit existing differently in the sense world, enlivens the spiritual world just as ideals vivify the sense world. This is a highly significant result of spiritual research, and it makes clear to us that sacrificial deaths are just as meaningful for the spiritual world, not only, as I set out yesterday, for the physical world, but equally for spiritual worlds. Among the souls living in spiritual worlds are those who look back on a course of life lived out, but there are also those who have learned that situations can be truncated with a jolt, and these are, in some respects, the inverse idealists of the spiritual world. This is how life's phenomena, life's riddles, gradually reveal themselves. And in times such as ours, when so very much of a mysterious nature can be presaged from blood and sorrow, one really does gain a sense how for the first time spiritual science can place the human being centrally into the whole totality of life. Humanity marches on. Previously, natural science did not exist. It has emerged from the dark gloaming of soul's striving. Spiritual science also has to arise. Humanity of the future will not be able to dispense with it. Nowadays it has many opponents, but human beings will increasingly sense the enigmas of existence, and with them an ever greater need to approach such mysteries of life through spiritual science. This must ever and anew be resurrected in our souls as the thought which unites us with our spiritual movement, and which in one sense points out how we are seeking something within our spiritual movement which has to become ever more widespread amongst humanity, something we need to hold on to through all the naturally occurring adversity of the present. Today I would like to emphasize, on the basis of today's considerations, just how seriously our times should now be warning us to do everything within our power to really embed spiritual science in human evolution. To that effect, I would like to strengthen this exhortation and make it all the more forceful because the conditions of the time do not allow us to be together as often as usual. Let me therefore direct this appeal to your very souls, that during these times of war, we work within our branch groups all the more faithfully and devotedly, even though the cooperative work among you, with, for instance, me, may only rarely be possible until more normal circumstances are restored. Traveling around the world is presently more difficult than usual, and it may be that we have to learn, really, really strongly, to rely upon ourselves in working within our individual branches. Doing whatever we possibly can in this respect will be immensely fruitful in the sense of the spiritual striving that must flow into human evolution. For again and ever again do we need to be directed toward this thought, the great sacrifices having to be made by such countless numbers of human beings at present, which are inwardly so enmeshed with all the mysteries and pain death buries within human evolution, that these events can only rightly relate to our soul life if we are able to observe human affairs and historical progress from the wider perspectives of spiritual science. It is not my intention to focus on all the hindrances and obstructions that may have reached your hearing, though they had to be discussed at a certain place. Yet these issues have shown how essential it is that quite factually we become convinced of the need for and effectiveness of this spiritual scientific movement, and that we separate from it all that arises out of our personal wishes and whims, as these will create hindrances and obstructions to the right progress of our spiritual scientific work. Spiritual science is so replete with content that we can engage with it quite objectively. Let us often, over and over again, powerfully remind our souls just how easy it is to allow personal, vain, or conceited ambitions to infiltrate what we should actually be getting hold of, the spiritual life pulsating throughout the world, which we should be allowing to inspire and seize us. Certain events have recently played out within our movement that are close to our souls and thoughts. Alas, blood is flowing out there, where large swaths of humanity are struggling for aims whose significance cannot today be gauged. And yet a spiritual movement exists which could, quite factually, provoke interest in the fact that one need not direct one's attention toward what is merely of a personal nature. Yet so much of a personal quality is still to be found here, just at a time when souls ought to feel obliged to empathize as one with these great events. This is a source of pain, that the potential for working together on what ought to be an impersonal project should still be fraught with so many personal issues. Well, especially today we need, continually and repeatedly, to look up from our individualized lives at what European humanity, and the whole of humanity beyond it too, is experiencing, and say to ourselves, the right aims achieved through adversity will only come to fruition if humanity's future evolution is suffused with what spiritual science can bequeath to it. If the fruits of the blood, the pain, the sorrow and loss can be united with thoughts distilled from spiritual science and survive into the future, then on the fields today demanding so many sacrifices, there will one day blossom a spiritual life that dignifies such sacrifice. Looking toward such times, we will close with these words, quote, from the courage of fighters, from the blood on fields of battle, from the grief of the bereft, from the sacrifice of people, there will grow fruit of spirit. If spirit conscious, souls will turn their thoughts to realms of spirit, close quote. May a good many souls among our number turn their thoughts toward spirit realms, so that what may blossom and bear fruit from their efforts becomes a blessing, not just a personal one, but a blessing for all humankind. In this sense do we want to cultivate our work most intensively, whatever life may bring, all the while holding firm to our task of working onward together. The end of Lecture 4.